A quick reminder before we get to today's episode, the science Kickstarter is underway. So if you aren't familiar with science, listen to this quick description of the graphic novel from writers Jason Inman and Ashley Victoria Robinson. It's a book I'm really excited about. I can't wait to get my hands on it and share it with my 7-year-old daughter. I think that Ashley and Jason are great writers, and their passion for comics is obvious, and it shows in the quality of their books. So take a quick listen and go pledge and share the Kickstarter with all your friends. Let's talk about your new Kickstarter. What's it all about?
It's called Science with an exclamation point.
So you gotta say it like that.
You gotta say it like Science.
Yeah, there you go. You gotta clip everybody's microphone when you say it.
Take care about that, everybody. Wake up.
Yeah. It stars a 14-year-old girl named Tamsin Trecru. It's more of a middle grade story, whereas Jupiter Jet was more of an all age story. So I guess that means it's a little bit edgier in the type of storytelling. But she is attending the Prometheus Institute. And it's the most amazing kind of school that has cute little robots called stats that fly around. It's got experimental physics. It's got amazing labs. But Tamsin's maybe not as happy to be there as she should be. And that's because her dead father used to be the headmaster there, and working there is what took him from her. So she's determined to, take the school down from the inside, like a normal teenager would want to do.
It's Harry Potter if Harry Potter wanted to destroy Hogwarts. There you go.
Tamsin is driven not only by, the trauma that comes along with losing a parent, but her father was a real smart science guy and downloaded his consciousness into her super cool glasses. So she actually sees a projection of him, and he can see everything that she's doing. And he's leading her on this quest, but he can also see like her interactions with her cute roommate, Garen, which is not what you want your dad to see when you're 14.
And the thing is, too, is that her father actually died when she was 3. So she never knew her father. The only father she has known is this holographic version of her father that has sort of existed around her. Science is a story that we think is pretty unique. I don't think there is a sort of teenager-y Star Trek science fiction-y with real facts out there. And if you like Jupiter Jet and you like our podcast, you like any of our tone, then I guarantee you're going to like this. You're going to like our flavor. And you hear about our passion for comics. Everything we do is how much we love comic books. And we inject that into our comics. Like, I think when you read our comics, especially Jupiter Jet and our stuff in the If anthologies and Love is Love, you can feel that love pouring through. And Science is the exact same thing. So if that doesn't convince you to buy Science or help us pre-order or make this book, then I don't know what will.
All right. If that sounds like something you might be interested in, I highly encourage you to go and check out the Kickstarter for Science. The good news is that in less than 36 hours, the Kickstarter was fully funded. So what that means for you, as someone who goes and does a pledge, you are guaranteed to get the book, right? Like, a lot of times you see something, a Kickstarter, you're excited, you pledge, and it doesn't get fully funded. And you're not out any cash, but you wanted the book. That's why you pledged in the first place. So you don't have to worry about that with Science. It's fully funded, and now we're on to stretch goals, right? And if you listen to our previous Spotlight episode on Science, you'll know that Jason and Ashley, the first thing they're going to do with any stretch goals they meet is add more content, more pages, more story. So again, I think it's completely worthwhile. I've already pledged. Go over there, do yourself a favor, and check it out. Welcome to episode 507 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. It's time for another Aftershock of Monday episode, and I'm going to be talking about a few of the books that came out this last Wednesday, September 12th from Aftershock. We had 3 titles hit the stands. Moth and Whisper number 1. I hope that you had a chance to listen to our episode last Monday with writer Ted Anderson and artist Jen Hickman about their gender fluid thief who was the child of Moth and Whisper, the two original greatest thieves in the city, and their child has to take over for them. And it's a great ride. It was really fun. Incredible art by Jen Hickman, and it was a really great conversation. So again, I hope you all had a chance to go and check that out and got a chance to pick up the first issue when it came out last Wednesday, September 12th. The other two Aftershock titles that hit stands last Wednesday were Hot Lunch Special number 2 and Volition number 2. They were both really, really great. And it really goes to show the diversity and quality of the Aftershock line. That these two books really couldn't be much more different. They're, one is, you know, science fiction and completely out there and fantastical and really great art and just awesome. Like, I really feel like it would make an incredible TV show, like a Netflix show, maybe in the, what was the recent Netflix show that came out with Joel Kinnaman that everybody was raving about? Altered Carbon, right? That's what it was. That's kind of the way I feel. Like, it's not that this book is about, you know, humans living forever and, you know, like Altered Carbon and that kind of thing, but similar in the look and the feel of that futuristic society and humans really messing with things that they probably shouldn't be messing with, you know, creating artificial intelligence, or in the case of Altered Carbon, prolonging life, maybe not the best idea, but that's the way I feel about the book. It's got some really great science fiction ideas. If you're a fan of science fiction, I think you'd really enjoy it. The book was just incredible. Now, the other title, Hot Lunch Special, kind of goes the other way. It's completely grounded in reality. It's about relationships and family and, you know, the choices we make based on what's best for our family, even knowing that those choices might not be the best choices from a moral standpoint or even a legal standpoint. But we do that because family, right? And family also doesn't always get along. And so, again, I don't think these two titles could really be much more different, but they're incredible in their own right. And I think it shows just the quality and the diversity of the line over at Aftershock. So let me talk a little bit about more about Volition. It's written by writer Ryan Parrott. The art is by Omar Francia, and the letters are by Marshall Dillon. It picks up in the past, so to speak, which is still our future, and we get to see a little bit of Amber T. It looks like she's a teen at this time. Again, I'm not completely sure how these artificial intelligent robots, how they age, if they purposefully, as they gain knowledge and experience, make themselves look older. Like, I'm not sure about that. But what we do see is that she had a boyfriend at one time who was human, which is a little strange. And she's sharing an experience with him that normally only robots can experience. And he's worried that it's going to turn him into a cantaloupe, but she promises that it's not. But really what she's doing is she's remembering this as she's in the decommissioned center. You know, we saw in the first issue, she had discovered something potentially dangerous to society, I guess, to some bigger conspiracy that's going on. Namely, maybe that Dr. Elizabeth Tremor is still around and able to be found, and perhaps she can stop this rust, a disease that's affecting robots and artificially intelligent beings. And that didn't sit too well with her superior, so he wanted her destroyed quickly and quietly, but she wakes up in the decommissioned center, and she manages to knock out the technician that's there working to decommission her. And then once she's there and has subdued this technician, the sensors detect that she's awake, and apparently that the technician has been knocked out, and it says that the gold level has been locked down, security protocols have been initiated, and there's a security team on the way. Right. So she obviously is not strong enough or big enough to break through the door. So she says she's going to have to look around and hope to find somebody to help her out. Meanwhile, we see the two cops that we met last issue interrogating another robot who apparently lives in that world, lives in that underworld, that black market world of supplying upgrades to robots that are becoming obsolete, basically. And they want to know what this guy knows about the recent amount of parts that have been dumped on the streets. But he really doesn't know much. And that in itself is a clue. It's like, look, somebody dumps this many parts on the street, there's always somebody talking. And right now, nobody's talking. And that must mean that the supplier is loaded enough to keep people quiet and dangerous enough to keep them away. So again, we're learning more about this world that Ryan Parrott has created and kind of the parameters of that world and the way the different, I don't want to say factions, but just the way they interact, right? Like the robot kind of seedy underworld of parts and black market upgrades and what's going on with these humans. Is Rust maybe something that they've created to try to get rid of artificial intelligence? They're hoping it'll continue to spread and become an epidemic that'll wipe out these robots. I mean, I'm totally speculating, but just trying to read between the lines here. So as we shift back to the DCOM center, the biggest and apparently strongest robot set to be decommissioned is Hale 19, who we also met last issue, was captured by those same two cops in the midst of trying to steal processors to sell on the black market. And Amber uses her ability to wake him up, and not apparently in a very pleasant way. How does he put it? Did you just raw jack my mainline? He said, sort of, yeah, I know it hurts and I'm really sorry, but you know, I need your help to get us out of here alive. So they don't have a whole lot of time, but Hale 19 comes up with a plan. And basically what they do is Amber goes around and wakes up as many of the robots set to be decommissioned as possible. So as the security team opens the door to the DCOM center, that decontamination level or decommission level rather, they're pretty much overrun with all these robots who are basically fighting for their lives. And the guards, the gold team, security team eventually uses an EMP to knock out all the robots. But unbeknownst to them, Amber and Hale have kind of snuck out the back, even though Hale had to literally rip off one of his arms to fit in the slot. And Amber's worried that they're going to turn the furnace on. But Hale's like, no, because they set off an EMP and that's going to keep this furnace off for hours. So obviously Hale, living on this side of the law, like living on the fringe, on the underground, has a lot of knowledge of things like this, and they do manage to escape. So we see the next day those two officers showing up at the decommission level and investigating. And first they want to know why there was only one tech on the floor. And it's like, well, budget cuts, take it up with the city. Like, okay, well, can you explain why a bunch of trigger-happy tech jockeys were too stupid to deploy a sensor drone before they set off this EMP, and that allowed two DCOMs to wander off into my city? And of course, you know, they don't have an answer for that. They're just gung-ho, trigger-happy, is exactly as she said. They didn't think to do that. But they do come across the arm of Hale 19, and one says to the other, does this arm look familiar? And Malia, the cop Malia, says, well, that middle finger sure does. So Hale 19 got away. And Malia says, well, the 19 must be how many lives this asshole's got. And they back up the footage a little bit. They see Amber there, and the fact that Amber was the one that kind of set this off by waking up Hale. And she looks like a custom bred T-Series. And why would one of those state-of-the-art, brand new robots be scheduled for decommission, right? And the tech that's handling the camera says, well, there's no record of any T-Series in holding. Like, excuse me? Well, he says it could be an input error, but either way, it's not my department. Amelia wants to know. So a brand new state-of-the-art robot starts a riot. No one knows who she is or where she came from. How does that make sense? And her partner says, well, on top of our den case, we got to track down two escaped DCOMs. Amelia responds, who says our job isn't glamorous? So we see in the harbor of the city, Hale and Amber hiding out, talking about what they're going to do. Hale says, I'll get you out of the city. I owe you that. But beyond that, you're on your own. And Amber's trying to convince him, hey, before I got thrown in there, you know, she explains how she was working as a nurse and she saw some visions from one of the robots infected with rust that leads her to believe she may know where Dr. Tremor is. And she wants Hale's help. But again, he's like, no. I don't want to get involved with that. I'll get you out of the city, but we're no Bonnie and Clyde, he says. And Amber's like, I think you mean Bonnie and Clyde. And Hale's like, look, the whole way I got myself into that mess was sticking my neck out for the wrong people. And if you think I'm in turn going to stick my neck out for a bunch of rusties, you got another thing coming. So I'll get you clear of the city. I owe you that. But whoever you're running from, like for whatever reason, whatever you think you found, whatever conspiracy, the people you're running from are some very bad people. And I don't want to get involved with that. So then the scene shifts to an illegal upgrade den in San Francisco, and we see a chopper, as they're called, start to work on a robot who goes by the name of Mr. Tin. And when he says, what are you here for? He says, actually, I'm here for you. And he starts firing, kills one of the workers in the upgrade shop, and shoots the other in the back. And as he's lying there, he summons another robot to help defend him. But Mr. Tin actually has a partner. It's Ingenue, who is a human partner. And as she's about to take out the chopper, as it were, she gets a call. And the person on the other eye, the other end of the line said, this is Dishi. I have a situation that requires another consultation. Like, you know, we're kind of busy right now. A very rich robot is paying us $25 to bring this chopper that gave him rust to him. It's only $10 if he's dead. So, you know, it's going to be a while. And the person on the other end of the line says, you know, I'll cover the difference. I need you here as soon as possible. So they take care of the chopper. And then tell Dishi that she consider them available. And as they head for the door, Mr. Tin says, Ingenue, you know we were only getting $5 for that, right? And Ingenue responds, yeah, but he didn't. And we get the to be continued. So it certainly seems like the fears that Hale 19 was expressing to Amber about there's going to be some bad people after you. Obviously, some kind of conspiracy with Rust that links with Dr. Tremor, that links with the hospital where all the artificial intelligence robots go when they contracted this disease. Clearly, there's something going on behind the scenes. And as I speculated earlier, it may be that there are powers that are in the upper echelon of society that don't want these robots around. They don't want artificial intelligence, but being that they've become so ingrained in life and, you know, they fought for their freedom. They were initially kind of indentured servants or slaves. They fought for their freedom. They've got rights. They have children, offspring. I mean, it's just like another species and it's not easy to eliminate, right? You can't just go around like killing them or finding another way to eliminate them. So if it turns out that this rust disease was actually created or manufactured or what have you to basically ultimately infect all of AI and kill all the robots, that's not something that's going to sit well. I mean, there are so many of them, but if you can do it through there's this natural disease or this disease that came out of upgrade or whatever, however, if you can spin it as we humans aren't responsible for it, then I'm sure the people that are behind it are hoping that they're not going to be held responsible. Humankind itself is not going to be held responsible. So again, just like when I had Ryan on the show the first time, big, big ideas happening here in Volition, which makes it a really compelling read. And beyond that, the art by Omar Francia, absolutely incredible. I mean, it was the art itself, as I started reading issue two, that started me thinking about things like The Expanse or Altered Carbon, because it's got such a slick digital painted feel, and it looked cinematic to me. It looked like, man, this could easily, these easily could be like screen captures from a TV show. And even beyond the overall tone and the colors and the feel and the mood of the world that Omar's created here, with input from Ryan, obviously. The other thing that's incredible is Omar's sense of storytelling, the emotion he puts into the faces of not only the humans, but of the robots, which isn't always easy to do because a lot of these robots don't necessarily have human features or have only rudimentary features, you know, sometimes just an eye or eyes and a mouth. But he still manages to convey emotion in these robotic faces. So that's a credit to him as an artist. And then the more human looking robots and the humans themselves, again, incredible job with faces and also incredible job with color. This is a very bright and vibrant book, but it does go dark at times. Like the scenes in the decommission level tend to be pretty dark, and it just gets, you get that feel that this is in a factory, down on a lower level, not a lot of light. It's not something you think that most people think about, you know, you're at the end of the line, and using darker colors and darker tones to illustrate this place just helps to set the mood for the story and set a tone for what's happening in the story. So incredible job by Omar. Ryan's doing a great job scripting this. It's a really, really fun read, and I can't wait to see where it goes from here. All right, on to the other title I was going to talk about, which is Hot Lunch Special number 2. Let me give the creative team really quickly. It's written by Elliot Rahal. We've got art by Jorge Fornes, letters by Taylor Esposito. And as I said, it's very much a different feel from Volition. And with the first issue, it was really good. I thought it was scripted incredibly well. I thought the art was good. But I still, at the end of the issue, although it was compelling and ended on somewhat of a cliffhanger, it certainly ended on an upswing of the story, I still wasn't quite sure what to expect. Didn't know if I had a good handle on the story. With issue 2, really compelling character work by Elliot Rahal, and I feel like I have a much better feel for the type of story he's trying to tell. You can almost think of it as like a Traffic or another Steven Soderbergh movie, where there's all these characters and there's all these moving parts. And the story is about the way these people's lives intersect with this backdrop of this family of immigrants who have created a food wholesale business where they're trying to expand their territory and live the American dream, but they kind of got in bed with some people they probably shouldn't have early on to kind of help them expand. And now they're paying the price for that, because again, it's about intersection, right? Like, we've got the Irish mob, we've got this Middle Eastern Qwerty family, and the family is extended and they're close, like immigrant families can tend to be, and they don't agree and they don't see things the same way, and their children have different values and different expectations, having grown up with a certain amount of privilege compared to what their parents and grandparents grew up with, and probably in a way much more identify themselves with being an American much more than the than their parents and the previous generations have. So, you know, think Fargo, think Traffic, with these lives intersecting and incredible character work, really emotional, because we do find out in this issue that with what happened at the end of the first issue, one of the Coreys, Ben, the youngest, has been killed. He was shot in his family's sandwich shop. The Irish mob was trying to send a message. They never meant to kill the boy. They just wanted to put a little pressure on the Corey family. But now what? Now where does the family go, right? And what happens when Ben's mother, Ben, who was killed, finds out that it has to do with decisions that her father has made about the family business and about repercussions from having got involved with the Irish mob, which was actually her grandfather's decision, not her father, Jordan. So again, there's a lot of family drama going on. There's a lot of character going on. And I wonder about growth from characters. You know, we've got the cop that's trying to put all the pieces together and understand what's going on. We've got the family who's lost someone. And maybe that as a consequence of that loss, they're going to have to bring a lot of what's been unsaid for years, and a lot of the skeletons in the closet are going to come out. At least that's what it seems like. And these aren't skeletons where, you know, they're not necessarily deep, dark secrets. They may be just things that people didn't ask about in the family because they didn't want to know. But in the back of their mind, they knew, yeah, we probably couldn't have expanded our business as quickly or as successfully as we have without having made some questionable decisions or play with that line of legality. But nobody wanted to ask because you didn't want to know the answer. You were fine just going along and being part of this successful family and taking advantage of the benefits of these decisions, right? So you've got that going on. And then on the other side, you've got the Irish mob who, it's also a family. They're not the center of the story, but we've certainly have met some of their family. And could there be retaliation there? What's their stake in it? What's their responsibility? It's certainly a catalyst to help move the story forward. So it's incredible character work. I expect to learn more about the family and the relationships. Issue 2 ends on more of an oh shit moment rather than a holy crap moment like the first issue did. Because as I said, Jordan, the grandfather, the current head of the Cordy family, the one who is kind of has final say, Ben's grandfather, you know, he's just as distraught as anyone in the family about losing Ben. And he's blaming himself. He says, you know, it's my fault that Ben got killed, and not realizing that Ben's mother is standing there and overhears it. And she asks him, "What did you just say?" And again, it's like, oh man, really don't want to have to hear this conversation. Because he's already beating himself up. And if it's a business decision, if it's a decision made in the best interest of the family, I mean, certainly he never envisioned this happening. I guess we'll have to wait for next issue to find out exactly how he's blaming himself. But again, I think it's an incredible issue. It's an incredible story. It's very compelling. And I don't know if a lot of people are reading Hot Lunch Special, but a lot of people should be reading Hot Lunch Special because it's the best family crime drama book I've read since I can remember. I'm trying to remember if I've read something as compelling and as accurate in its depictions of relationships between family. I just don't know that I have, but I can think of so many different things in other media that seem to be in this kind of same genre that are excellent. And so I think if you're a fan of like The Godfather or Sopranos, things like that, then you would absolutely love this. This is a book I would really recommend to people who like No Country for Old Men, Fargo, things like that. I think they would absolutely love this. So even if it's not doing extremely well in single issues, I gotta believe the trade is just gonna blow it out of the water, because this is really, really inspired storytelling. And I gotta think that the cream rises to the top, and there should be more people talking about this book. I know I'm gonna be promoting the heck out of it every chance I get, because it's absolutely spectacular. So kudos to Elliot Rahal and Jorge Fornes for a great second issue, and I can't wait for issue 3. The other thing that I'll mention in this episode is a couple of the books that are coming out from Aftershock this coming week. So that's the 19th. They've got Cold War Volume 1 trade paperback from Christopher Sabella and Hayden Sherman, which is a really interesting take on future and war and cryogenics. It's kind of out there. And I read them as singles. I haven't gone back and reread everything now that the whole thing is out. And I think it'll read better in one sitting or as a trade. So that's out there this Wednesday. And we had Christopher Sabella on the show way back when it was first being released. So if you're curious, just do a search for that episode, and you can find out more details about Cold War. We've also got Patience, Conviction, Revenge, number one, which when I read the description, I was like, I don't know if I'm going to like this. It sounds kind of weird, but it's Aftershock, so I know I'm going to check out at least the first issue. About a guy who used to be part of a crime syndicate in Las Vegas, and then he got pushed out, and he's been living out in the middle of the desert, and he's created an army of robots, and now he's coming back to get his revenge. But it's like almost a post-apocalyptic setting. It's not the Vegas you know. It's not the Vegas you can fly into and go gambling and spend the weekend. It's not that Vegas. It's a different type of Vegas. So I just wasn't sure how much I would enjoy it. But man, the first issue was really enjoyable. It's got almost a kind of a tongue-in-cheek East of West feel, if you are familiar with that Jonathan Hickman story. Just kind of an Old West, lone gunslinger kind of feel. But again, with humor and a little bit of weirdness. So I really did enjoy the first issue. Also, this Wednesday from Aftershock, Lost City Explorers number 4 from Zach Kaplan and Alvaro Saraceca. Really starting to get that Goonies vibe big time. Big time. And Helena, or Hel, the main character, really makes a leap of faith in this issue, I'll say, to try to find out once and for all if her father is alive. And we do get an answer to that question in this issue. So it ends on a little bit of a cliffhanger, and I can't wait to see what the next issue holds. But it's been a whole heck of a lot of fun, and I think this is another title. I haven't heard enough people talking about it because it's absolutely outstanding. And I think it'll be one that's great to give people who aren't comics readers but are interested in becoming comics readers, because just about everybody can relate to the Goonies on one level or another. And these are teenagers in over their head on an adventure underneath New York City, Lost City of Atlantis, searching for their dad. And it's everything it's cracked up to be, with incredible art by Alvaro Saraceca. And I can't wait to see the art on the next issue, because we're going to start seeing some things a little off the beaten path, I think. It's not necessarily going to be tunnels under New York City anymore. The setting's kind of shifted a little bit, and I can't wait to see how Alvaro draws this new setting. So those are the things to be on the lookout for this Wednesday from Aftershock. Once again, I want to thank everybody for joining. Please tell your friends about us, subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on iTunes. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter. twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to follow all our convention coverage as well as the release of new episodes. So once again, I want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.